Blog Talk Radio.
Out of Touch Radio. With your host, Bill Maupin.
We are alternative radio with a twist on subject matter that really does matter.
Join us on our website at www.outoftouchradio.com. Our call-in number is 646-716-4228. Our guest today is former Army helicopter pilot and Air Force intelligence officer who's been writing about the UFO phenomenon for more than 25 years. He has written or co-written numerous books on the subject, including UFO Crash at Roswell, The Truth About UFO Crash at Roswell, and A History of UFO Crashes, Kevin Randall. We will be discussing his new book, Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky, A History of Famous Incidents, Conspiracies, and Cover-Ups.
Right. Welcome to Out of Touch Radio. Today is September the 13th of 2010. Where has the time gone? Today we want to dedicate this show. 9/11 was 2 days ago, and we're going to dedicate the show to the families of the victims of 9/11. I hope everyone had a wonderful start to their week. Like I said, I don't know where the time went. We're going to have an incredible show today with our host, Kevin Randall. And right now we're going to bring in Gina Krizel with Pocket Full of Insight. How you doing, Gina?
Hi there, Bill. Today is a great day. So far, so good.
All right.
We're going to talk a little bit today about amulets and talismans. First of all, what an amulet is an object left in its natural state that we use for a purpose. And a talisman is an object constructed, made, decorated for a particular purpose. And amulets and talismans have been carried by people for thousands of years to bring about certain conditions in their life. Now, for example, with an amulet, a bear claw, a claw of an animal, it can be a natural amulet. Like, for example, a cat, one of your domesticated cat's claws, or sometimes they fall off, or dog's claws, they can be good for protection. You know, and even other animals in the wild, sometimes people have, you know, different feathers, things like that. They can be used for certain purposes depending on the animal that you find that from. Also, things like heart-shaped lucky stones that you might just find in a gravel parking lot, that can be a great thing for a romance amulet. You know, we see a lot of naturally occurring shapes, and they can be used as amulets for purposes in our life.
So
something else I wanted to mention, even with talismans, like people can make things with symbols on them, like say for increasing money. You know, the dollar sign symbol is definitely something that can be put on an object along with, you know, maybe numbers of special significance or things that you see for good luck. You can create something out of paper or carve it out of wood, sew it on fabric, but there's different ways to make things to bring about certain purposes that things that we want to achieve in our lives.
All right. And can they learn more at your website about talismans and amulets?
Well, I don't have anything up on my website about it, but if people have questions, they're certainly willing to ask. And, you know, there's a lot of material out there on how to make and design such things. But if people want to contact me through email, I'd be happy to give them some information.
Yeah, go ahead and give them your email address and your web address.
My website, GinaKruzel.com, G-I-N-A-K-R-U-Z-E-L. And my email address, GinaKruzel@gmail.com.
All right. Thank you, Gina, and you have a wonderful week.
Thank you, Bill. You do the same.
All right. Wonderful information there. And our guest today, Kevin Randall, he's a retired lieutenant colonel who served in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot and in Iraq as a battalion intelligence officer. Kevin has been investigating UFO sightings for more than 30 years. He's been writing dozens of books and magazine articles on the subject and has lectured throughout the United States and Europe. He's considered an expert by those inside and outside the UFO field, and his opinions and assistance have been sought by government officials, members of the news media, and other UFO researchers. Kevin has appeared on hundreds of radio programs and dozens of television documentaries and specials, including The Today Show, Good Morning America, 48 Hours, Larry King Live, and more. He writes for the blog, A Different Perspective, which can be found at kevinrandall.blogspot.com. Let's welcome Kevin Randall. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm doing fine. Now, we're not going to compete because, as you know, I was in the United States Marine Corps, and you were an officer in the Army, correct?
I was an officer in the Army, I was an officer in the Air Force, and I was an enlisted guy in the Army, and I was a warrant officer in the Army. I just sort of meandered around until I found my way.
You spent a lot of time in the military, which brings me to the question, how did you get started in the business of UFOs, Kevin?
I always blame my mom for that. She was a fan of science fiction, which is discussions of alien civilizations, interstellar flight, and visitation. And it's not a big step from the science fiction realm into UFOs, which is about alien civilizations and interstellar travel and visitation. So I just sort of moved from the realm of science fiction into UFOs, and it all started with my mom.
And when making that transition, I'm sure you had a couple of constituents that were, what are you doing?
I never had any problem in the military with my UFO interest at all. The when I first reported to Richard Guevara Air Force Base in Kansas City, for example, the escort officer showing me around the base learned of my interest and said that he'd read this interesting article about UFOs in a magazine, and I said, yeah, I wrote that. So it's always been there, and everybody's always known it. It's never really caused any trouble at all. When I was becoming an intelligence officer, I, of course, had to have a top-secret clearance, and
sure.
It turned out that the fellow doing the background investigation for the Army lived, or for the Air Force, I'm sorry, for the Air Force, or for the military, lived across the street from my father and told me later that in the file that he sent forward, there were four magazine articles that I had written about UFOs, two of them very critical about the Air Force handling of the UFO phenomenon, but I got my security clearance and there was no problem. And then when I went back into the Army or the National Guard prior to going to Iraq, again, I had to have a top secret clearance, and there was absolutely no problem in getting it. The only problem was they had an awful lot of them they had to do, and so I fell into that line somewhere. But there was, but at the time that I needed the clearance, it was issued, so I've had no problems with that.
Sure. And, you know, in your investigations into UFOs, you spend quite a bit of time trying to decipher the real from the not real, right?
I think it's important, if we're going to do UFO investigation, that we learn exactly what's going on. And too often, I think some of the investigators, some of the researchers, some of the people interested in it just embrace everything. You come up with the wildest, most cockamamie story, and there are people who are going to believe it, and then become offended when you suggest, well, maybe this isn't exactly the way things happened. But I think that if we're going to do this right and we're going to move to bringing in science, bringing in the news media, bringing in people who we'd like to understand what was going on, that it's necessary that we, inside the UFO community, the ones that expose the hoaxes and expose the frauds. And I think frequently that happens, and more often than not, it's forgotten that it was we inside the community who exposed these people. They'll say, well, that was a well-known hoax, and we'll say, yeah, we're the ones that pointed that out. You guys didn't get the information. And I think specifically of Frank Kaufman here, there are any number of people who said that Kaufman was a liar simply because he talked about a crash of a UFO at Roswell. And that's sure. not a legitimate reason for rejecting his testimony because you don't like it. But it was we inside the community, and when I say we, I really should give the credit to Mark Rodiger, Mark Chesney, and Don Schmidt, who found the absolute evidence that Kaufman had been making up his involvement in the Roswell case. But we have the proof now. We can say this without fear of contradiction, and it was we inside the community who discovered that proof.
Yeah. And speaking of Roswell, one of the renowned UFO cases in history, you know, there was a lot of talk at the beginning that, yeah, there really was a UFO crash. And suddenly they brought out this weather balloon. Why does the government want to keep this covered up, even today?
Today, I have no clue. I don't know why the cover-up persists to today. Back in 1947, it made perfect sense. We just come out of a very disastrous war.
Sure.
We had some competitors in the world that weren't the nicest people, and I'm thinking specifically of the Soviets. If we found ourselves in possession of a technology that would allow us to leap ahead of our competitors, and clearly extraterrestrial technology would do that, I can understand them wanting to keep it secret, and if they can convince people that nothing happened there, they don't have to worry about espionage, because you don't begin a spy mission to uncover the secrets if you don't believe there's a secret there to uncover. You just let that go. So it made perfect sense in 1947 that they would want an opportunity to exploit this without having to worry about our competitors. It also seems to me that in 1947 they didn't really have any answers. They didn't know whether these things were hostile. They didn't know whether the thing was the beginnings of an invasion. They just really had no clues. And I think it makes sense for them to take an opportunity to learn about what was going on as much as they could before they made the announcement that, yeah, there's these creatures from another world coming to Earth. Once we get beyond that, once it's clear that it's not an invasion, and I think the length of time since 1947 kind of suggests that. But also, I mean, if you're a year and a half, 2 years down the road, you're pretty sure there's not an invasion coming. I don't know why they would continue to hide this stuff. It's not as if people would panic in today's world. We're much more sophisticated. We've been exposed to everything from Star Trek to Star Wars. We've seen all kinds of scenarios. We even know about the invasion of the body snatchers, and the only reason I bring that up is Kevin McCarthy, who was a star of the original movie, passed away today, or passed away, I guess, Saturday, and it was just announced today. So we're beyond all of that, and we're much more sophisticated. So I don't think there would be this panic. There might be a momentary blip. I know Richard Dolan doesn't agree with this. Richard Dolan has just done a book, After Disclosure, about all the bad things that would happen, and I think his view is overly pessimistic. But it's interesting to see what he thinks would happen after the disclosure has been made. But I think we're beyond that as well, and we've moved down that road. So I don't understand why it persists till today.
And a lot of other countries have actually opened up their cases of, you know, UFO discoveries, and why we won't do it just is beyond me. And I mean, we could look back as recent as, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't mean to interrupt, but we were among the first to open up the Project Blue Book files have been open since 1976. So we've had our opportunity to look at the Project Blue Book files since that time. And I was one of the first researchers, if not the very first, to get an opportunity to look at the files while they were still housed at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. So the United States has opened quite a bit of material, and when we look at some of the other countries, they haven't opened everything, and neither have we. But we've opened up a lot of our material as well.
Sure. And we do appreciate the countless hours of work that you've put in. You know, you've got some people out there that think you, among others, are crazy. But, we appreciate it because there is something going on out here, and we could take a look as recent as the lights in Phoenix. Did you do any work on that at all?
I've talked to some people out there. I mean, that was in 1997, and some of the original reports are clearly flares, as has been reported endlessly. Some of the sightings clearly are not flares. And there was the sighting of this triangular object that began in, Tucson, and moved up the state of Arizona toward Las Vegas and what would eventually become Area 51. So there were some very interesting sightings there. There were some very interesting police sightings. But some of the most dramatic footage that has been released is clearly of flares. We have to look at all of that sort of thing. But there's been other sightings. There's the Stephenville, Texas sightings much more recently. There was the affair in Chicago at O'Hare where the pilots and ground crew saw an object moving above the airport. So there's some very interesting sightings going on. But here's something else.
Before you go into that, when was that sighting in Chicago at O'Hare?
October of 2009, I think.
Okay.
But what I was going to say is what I find interesting, and actually Carl Flock and I discussed this a number of years ago, was that it doesn't seem that the UFO sightings we get today are the same robust nature that we were getting in the late 40s and the 1950s. Just not the same kind of diversity, not the same kind of activity. It's much more limited than it had been, and we were speculating about why that might be. And one of the things we thought of is kind of like our activities on the moon. We got there in 1969. We sent a number of missions back through 1972, and since that point, no other manned missions have gone to the moon. We've done some robotic or probes. We crashed that spacecraft into the moon to see if we could find water. And the same thing is, we've put some probes onto Mars, and we've done some interesting things on Mars. But, once we finish the manned missions to the moon, we just haven't been back with the same kind of diversity that we were in the late 60s and the early 70s. And Carl and I wondered if that wasn't what had happened, that the alien creatures, whomever they are, wherever they came from, and how many different worlds they might have come from, discovered us in the 1940s. They came, they studied us for a while, realized we posed no threat to them because we weren't going to get out of the solar system anytime soon. They did their research and they went home. And periodically they come back, take a look, see where we are, and then go home. But their initial great research, they came, they gathered everything they possibly could as quickly as they could, and they went home. So we wondered if that might not be a possibility of why we don't seem to get the same kind of sightings that we used to get.
Sure. And speaking of sightings, in your book, you detail some of the sightings or crashes prior to Roswell. Can we talk about that for a moment?
Well, there's quite a bit of stuff. If we take a look at some of the historical records, but actually some of the ideas that precede the historical record. There's talk of UFO crashes in China as much as 12,000 years ago. Well, it's based on cave paintings and that sort of thing, and I wonder how good the interpretation might be. It might be kind of sloppy interpretation. I look at a case from 840 AD in France, because here is what some people have called a UFO crash. And the capture of four of the creatures, three male and one female, that they were going to execute in some fashion. But I wanted to look at that to show how the interpretation of the words used them. They talk about cloud ships, and some people have interpreted that to mean ships that fly in the clouds, which would be flying saucers, obviously would be extraterrestrial in 840 AD, but it could also refer to the white sails looking like clouds on the horizon. The ship with big billowing sails could be considered a cloud ship. So it's just really I wanted to look at the interpretation there and how that story has been sort of embraced by the UFO community for decades. But the really interesting stuff begins around the end of the last century with the Great Airship of 1897. We had an awful lot of interesting things there, Aurora, Texas being one of them. And I know there's people inside the UFO community who believe this is a legitimate UFO crash. I think it's a hoax based on the research I did and having gone there. And I think one of the best proofs of that is that in, I think, 1907 and then again in 1912, so this is 10 years and 15 years after the events took place, there were histories sure. written of Wise County, Texas, which Aurora, Texas, and Wise County, there's not one mention of this UFO crash, this airship explosion over Aurora, Texas. And I'm thinking that this is prior to the CIA, it's prior to the Air Force, it's prior to anybody getting really involved in this sort of thing. If this event took place, why isn't it mentioned in those histories? Because people would still have been talking about it 10 years after the fact. And you go back and you discover that the guy who wrote the original story was a stringer for the Dallas Morning News who's from the Aurora, Texas area, and he thought his town was getting the short shift because the railroad had gone elsewhere and it was kind of dying out, and he wanted to draw people back into the area, so he came up with this idea that the airship had crashed in Aurora, they buried the pilot in the graveyard, and they had all this debris and all this interesting thing going on. But when I got to the town in the early 1970s, I mean, I'm there like 73 years after the event, so there's people still around who were there in 1897, so I talked to them, and they didn't remember anything about it. But what's interesting, now some of those same people who were talked to people three or four years after I was there were telling different stories and how they remember the airship crash or their parents talking about the airship crash. So that's kind of interesting. Yeah. But I think, you know, the evidence is pretty persuasive that event didn't take place. It was a hoax. And the airship, if you read the stories of the airship, a lot of them involved people talking about they were on their way to Cuba to bomb the Spanish, and this is just prior to the Spanish-American War. And so you've got an awful lot of stuff in the papers where they said, well, the airship landed, the airship crashed, and we talked to the pilots, and we talked to the crew, and they said, well, they were practicing their bombing missions, or they were on their way to Cuba to bomb the Spanish, and that sort of thing. So it's clear that a lot of the stuff that came out of the 1897 airship stories are hoaxes now. Jerry Clark thinks there's a solid core of stories that began in 1896, and then it kind of blew up from there, if you will. I'm not so sure there was a solid core of stories. It just doesn't seem like there was. But he and I disagree on that point. So we've got, you know, the airship in 1897. There's other stories, and a number of them sound an awful lot like bolides, and one of them that. What I did when I was putting the book together is I went and I looked at a lot of the lists of UFO crashes that others had put together and saw some of them were nearly 300 events long, and I thought, this is preposterous. There can't have been that many events because we'd be having a different discussion. And one of the stories that I came across clearly is a bolide, a bright meteor seen in the daylight based on the description that you read in the newspaper. This bright light seen roaring over the town and exploded. Well, bolides do that, and we now know that. We know that there's often sonic booms associated with bolides. We know that oftentimes that the forces of them cause them to detonate in the atmosphere probably 5 or 6 miles high. They don't reach the ground. And so here was one where they talked about it being a meteor, and yet people have translated that into some kind of a UFO event or an extraterrestrial event with a UFO crash. So, I wanted to look at all of those sorts of things and then move, of course, finally up to the Aurora crash, the Roswell crash, sort of delineates the modern era of UFO crash reports.
Sure. Well, before we move, forward, there's a couple of things that I'd like to talk about, one being Majestic 12, but one in particular that I find quite interesting is the UFO battle over Nuremberg, Germany, in 1561. Now, I want the listeners to listen to the summary that I have here. At sunrise on the 14th of April, 1561, the citizens of Nuremberg beheld a very frightful spectacle. The sky appeared to fill with cylindrical objects from which red, black, orange, and blue, white discs and globes emerged. Crosses and tubes resembling cannon barrels also appeared, whereupon the objects promptly began to fight one another. This event is depicted in a famous 16th century woodcut by Hans Glasser. Are you familiar? I know you are. So can we talk about that before we take a break?
It's one of the things. Russ Estes and I did a book called Spaceships of the Visitors, and that was one of the events we talked about. But once again, we end up with the interpretation of an event without having the opportunity to talk to the people who made the observations. So it can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. So I'm always
I was going to ask you, did you do like a semi-investigation on this, or did you do any work on this one?
Other than check the various sources that we could find. That was the only thing that we really did. And it was in part of the book where we kind of rushed through some of the earlier UFO sighting events. There was one, for example, where Roman soldiers refused to cross a river because there were two flaming shields seen that fly by. Well, that could easily be meteors as opposed to some kind of bright object. But it could also be some kind of an object hovering over the river. So it's hard to interpret what the ancients were talking about given their level of sophistication, their level of natural knowledge. They didn't know these sorts of things. They didn't understand meteors. They didn't understand comets. They didn't understand a lot of the meteorological phenomena that are quite clear to us today. So it's very hard to make to determine exactly what was going on in those events. So when I do these sorts of books, I look at them from the point of view of the possible natural interpretations of them as well, and then try to look at the stuff from what we might call the modern era, where we have an opportunity to talk to the people who were involved.
Sure. Why, in your interpretation, why do saucers crash?
I think it's like anything else. The creatures building them are not perfect. And anything that you build is not going to be perfect. And even if you could build, I always kind of do it this way, if we as humans could build the perfect machine, there's going to be some guy who's going to forget to tighten a nut or push the wrong button. And I think that we have so few crashes, legitimate crashes, that what we're looking at is somebody pushed the wrong button or somebody didn't tighten the right bolt, or somebody forgot to flush the toilet, for crying out loud. The Apollo 13, they were recycling the waste products in it. It's during the oxygen or something, and it caused an explosion. So somebody didn't do something right, and that causes these catastrophic failures.
Sure. Our call-in number is 646-716-4228, and Kevin will be taking questions that you might have regarding his book and any other questions that you might have. Kevin, we're going to take a break here, and we'll be back.
I'll be waiting.
Our guest today, Mr. Kevin Randall, retired Lieutenant Colonel with the United States Army. Also author of Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky, a history of famous incidents, conspiracies, and cover-ups. When the scientific community asks for evidence of alien visitation, it is to Kevin Randall's work they turn. Here is a complete update of research into the reports of alien spaceship crashes that provides new insights into many of the older cases and adds depth to new ones being reported. Written by one of the leading experts in the UFO field, Crash, When UFOs from the Sky, provides a solution to cases that seem perplexing and adds depth to those that have no terrestrial solution. This fascinating book provides the latest information on the controversial Roswell UFO crash, explores the first suggestions of a UFO crash from the 19th century. It explains the controversy surrounding the 1950 Del Rio UFO crash, updates the Las Vegas UFO crash of April 1962, provide solutions for some of the more controversial UFO crashes. Crash. It's hard to believe there are nearly 200 to 300 claims of UFO crashes around the world, going back for the past few hundred years, if not thousands of years. Sure, the more famous ones are known to many in the UFO community, like Roswell, Kecksburg, and Chag Harbor. But it's the lesser-known reports that really got us thinking here. Kevin Randall did an excellent job of cataloging the events, the witnesses, the evidence, the cover-ups, and the hoaxes. This book was very well written and can simply be described as a page-turner that you won't be able to put down. You can find his book at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com or at our website www.outoftouchradio.com. There's a link there under his picture. Click there and that will take you to his website, or you can purchase it at amazon.com. Crash.
Now, back to your host, Bill Maupin.
All right, Kevin, that was one of your friends there getting us back here. Hey, Kevin.
Yes.
In all of your research that you've done, which one stands out in your mind as the most provocative discoveries or indications that, yes, we are being visited, and yes, UFOs do crash?
The best one probably is a Roswell case, based on the number of witnesses that we've been able to talk to, the people who were involved.
How did I know that?
Pardon me?
Said, how did I know that?
Well, it's the best documented one. Well, the one where there's the most witnesses. The best documented case might be Chag Harbor, simply because Chris Stiles and Don Ledger have been able to uncover so many official documents that relate to it. Beginning in October of 1967, and this was an event that again a lot of people on the ground saw it. There's a photograph of the thing in the sky. There's a lot of documentation from the Canadian government about their attempts to recover whatever fell into Chag Harbor. And what's interesting about this is back in 1966, the U.S. Air Force had commissioned the University of Colorado to study UFOs, find out what's going on. Chag Harbor takes place while they're supposedly studying UFOs, and their investigation was they made a phone call to Canada, found out that some of the witnesses were teenagers and didn't bother to do anything else. Canadian government was involved. The American government was involved. Soviet Union might have been involved in trying to retrieve this thing, but the Condon Committee couldn't be bothered to go to Canada to see if there was anything to it, even though that's what they were supposed to be doing. They had the money. They were being paid the money to investigate UFOs. And here was an opportunity to investigate what turns out to be a very well-documented case.
Now, the Canadian government kept the wraps on that one, right?
Absolutely.
For the most part.
Yes, and Chris Stiles and Don Ledger talk about it. I think their book is Dark Object. They talk about their attempts to uncover the documentation from this event back in 1967, and how some of the documentation mysteriously disappeared, how some of the documentation they were able to discover through their investigation. So it's quite a fascinating story. But yes, the Canadian government probably, along with the American government, attempted to keep the keep this whole thing under wraps.
Question for you. Why don't they just make themselves known? Why don't they just, land, get out and say, yes, we're here, we come in peace, whatever? What would you say? Why won't they do it?
I have no clue. In the UFO field, there's a lot of speculation about this. One of them is centers around the Prime Directive, which is observe but don't interfere, the old Star Trek Prime Directive. But of course they do let themselves be seen and photographed, well maybe not let themselves be seen, but we are aware of their presence, so that suggests one thing. But why they haven't landed and made themselves known, I really don't know. I mean, we're talking about an alien race with alien motivations, and it's very hard to deduce what their motivating factors might be.
What are your views on abductions?
I believe, and this is where I commit ufological suicide periodically, but I believe that the alien abduction phenomenon is terrestrially based, that it really has nothing to do with extraterrestrials. Having said that, I'll also add that if alien abduction was taking place, I would expect it to be more like the Barney and Betty Hill case than what we see today with the same people being abducted multiple times, the creatures coming into the house, even though I was the first one to ever report that. I investigated a case back in 1976, and one of the things that the witness said was that the aliens had come into the house to take them out. It was the first time that anybody had reported that. I now believe, based on my study of that case, that this was an episode of sleep paralysis, that the woman experienced sleep paralysis, which is by no means an explanation for all cases of alien abduction, but in this one specific case, I think it fits very, very well. So alien abduction, I believe, is terrestrially based, but like...
Well, the Barney Hill, you said that you do see credence in the story of the Betty and Barney Hill.
No, I said that if abduction was taking place, I would expect it to be more like the Barney and Betty Hill case. Not that necessarily the Barney and Betty Hill case is truly alien abduction. I'm saying that's what I would expect the alien abduction scenario to look like.
Sure. Okay. Let's talk about some of, actually an article that I read in UFO magazine. You frequently write for them, right?
I have a column that appears regularly in UFO magazine, yes.
And you wrote about Majestic 12 at one point, right?
I've done quite a bit. I did a whole book on Majestic 12 called Case MJ-12, sure. So yes. I've written about MJ-12, right. Yes.
Can we talk about those documents?
I think I found the fatal flaw in the Eisenhower briefing document, and it comes out of the crash book. There was a fellow named Robert B. Willingham who claimed to observed a UFO crash in, well, originally 1948, and then 1950, and finally 1955. He could apparently get the date right. But Willingham, I believed originally, back when I first heard his story in the late 1980s because he was a retired colonel from the Air Force. So I believed his story. When I was putting together Crash, I thought, well, let's see what's going on here in the Willingham story. And I did some research into that and discovered that the story had been radically altered. Willingham had changed the dates. He changed the aircraft he was flying. He changed the locations. He changed all kinds of stuff. And I thought, well, this doesn't bode well. And I asked the authors of a book about his experiences if they bothered to check his credentials. And they said no. They thought that Bruce McAbee had done it. I emailed Bruce and asked him, and he said no. He thought Todd Zeckel had done it. And I determined that nobody had done it. So I wrote I attempted to get his military record from St. Louis, and anybody who's been in the military understands when you are removed from active duty, when you are discharged from active duty, or when you get off out of the active reserve or the National Guard, your records end up in St. Louis for storage. So I wrote to them and asked, the only record they have for Robert V. Willingham is that he was a very low-ranking enlisted man who entered the service in December of 1945, technically making him a veteran of World War II, and he was released in January of 1947. So he spent, 14 months, in the Army. No record of him being in the Air Force, no record of him being a fighter pilot, no record of him being a colonel, nothing. I asked for documentation. All I got were documents that suggested he'd been in the Civil Air Patrol, which is an auxiliary of the Air Force, but it's a civilian auxiliary. They do search and rescue. They have a cadet program to teach boys and girls, teenagers, about aviation and the Air Force and that sort of thing, but they're not an official organ, a component of the Air Force. You don't get retirement points for being in the Air Force or in the Civil Air Patrol. I could find nothing to document this long Air Force experience. And if Willingham wasn't an Air Force fighter pilot, then the entire Del Rio story collapsed. This is important to MJ-12 for this reason. If you remember, the Eisenhower briefing document, which talks mostly about Roswell, has one paragraph that says on December 6, 1950, another object was seen to crash near Del Rio. This is the Willingham story, and it's clearly a hoax. So if the Willingham story is a hoax, what does that lead you to conclude about the MJ-12 documents, the Eisenhower briefing document? The people, if they were putting together a document for the president, they would not have included Del Rio because it's a hoax. But the other thing is that nothing about that story really came out until 1968 when Willingham told the original story. I spent a year and a half looking for the original story in the newspaper. I finally found in Skylook, which was the precursor to the MUFON Journal, I found a one paragraph in there from 1968. I think it's the February-March issue of Skylook. It's on page 3, and it talks about Colonel Robert Willingham, a Civil Air Patrol officer, seeing three objects, one of which crashed. So the story changed significantly from that point to where we are today. And I think what happened, and we can connect the dots, that Willingham was talking to Zeckel. Zeckel was talking to Bill Moore, and there are people who believe Bill Moore originated the MJ-12 documents. We can connect the dots all the way from Willingham to Moore to MJ-12.
Hmm. Wow. What do you think it is that we, the people, can do to have our government and other governments, for that matter, you know, actually come clean and let us know the truth?
What we need to do is self-police. And I think we got very close in the mid-1990s. I think that with the investigations of Roswell going on and things that we were learning about that case, we got very close, and we forced the Air Force to reinvestigate and come up with their new Project Mogul explanation. But I think what we need to do is be very careful in what we accept as reality, although I think of the Mythbusters, I reject your reality and substitute my own, but carefully investigate the UFO sightings. Reject those where there is a clear answer, and we have trouble doing that. Once we've embraced the sighting as unidentified, we rarely want to see it go away. But I think we need to sort of raise our level of investigation so that we are very careful in our gathering of the evidence, so that when the news media or scientific community comes to us, we have the facts and figures there, and we don't end up with some case that is shaky at best. And that's where we get into some of the problems with the subsets of UFO research. And I think a subset would be the crash retrievals. It would be a subset. The abduction phenomena would be a subset. Cattle mutilations would be a subset. Landing trace cases would be a subset of all of this sort of thing. And we need to look for the cases where we have multiple chains of evidence, witness testimony, some kind of instrumentality involved, whether it be radar or good. And I now, in today's world, hesitate with photographic evidence because it's so easy to manipulate.
Sure.
But if we had a series of photographs taken in like two or three separate locations of a single event that allowed for triangulation, so you could get an idea of the size, you get an idea of the direction, you get an idea of the speed, you could all this information you could get. If we had some kind of a case like that with multiple witnesses and maybe radar returns, then we would have just one heck of a fine case. And if the thing landed,
sure, now,
we'd have even...
Didn't we almost get close to that with Phoenix?
I would say we got closer with the Leveland sightings from 1957, where we had people in 13 different locations talking about the UFO near them, suppressing the car engines, their radios, their headlights, reporting it all to the sheriff, possibility of a landing trace case. So we had an awful lot of that stuff in 1957 at Leveland, but of course the Air Force investigated. They spent almost a day down there and had a single NCO talk to three people, and that was their explanation. Well, there's only three people, because a witness doesn't exist unless the Air Force had talked to them, and they didn't like the witnesses, so they just wrote the whole thing off. We've gotten close a number of times. Phoenix would be a good example. McMinnville would be a fine example. I think Washington Nationals, where the objects were seen over Washington on two consecutive Saturday nights. They were seen on radar, multiple radar sets. We had pilots in the air, both commercial and military pilots, and this was responsible for what I think of as the greatest headline I've ever seen in a newspaper, which comes right out of a science fiction movie. Says saucer swarm over Capitol. It was in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It was the banner headline in July of 1952, and I made a copy of that because it's such a great headline. But we've had that a number of times. We've gotten close a number of times, but there's always the debunking. There's always the Air Force in there, and they're always stirring the pot to make it look like we don't have the information we have or the data we have, and they throw enough mud that it obscures the good work being done.
Hey, now let's ask you, have you yourself ever seen an unidentified flying object that you would consider to be a saucer?
Well, when you phrase it that way, no. Back in the olden days, when I was a teenager, I belonged to the Denver UFO Society. I grew up in Denver, Colorado. And we were south of Denver on a, must have been a Sunday night, and having some kind of a meeting on a ranch down there. And we were all sitting around the campfire and looked up, and we saw an object cross the sky from the north to the south. And at the time, there weren't satellites in polar orbits. We could find nothing that should have been there, but it was just a single light. Looks all for all the world when you see the space station go over, you know, it's just a light moving across the sky. That's exactly what it looked like. We couldn't find any record of a satellite in a polar orbit in that time frame that we should have been able to see. But it was just a point of light crossing the sky, and across from the northern horizon to the southern horizon. That's as close as I've ever come.
Okay. All right. And tell us what you've got going on for the rest of the year. It's not much left, but I'm sure you got some things planned this year, right?
Well, I'm working on a book called Confessions of a Ufologist that starts out with, and actually talks about my sighting with the Denver UFO Society, or my witnessing of a light in the sky.
Okay.
But it also talks about I had an opportunity to visit with Carol Wayne Watts, who was sort of one of the first abductee type guys, sort of a contactee, sort of an abductee. Took place in 1967, but I had a chance to talk with him when I first got into the Army, and it just moves through that through all of that. I've gotten up to the point where I'm doing a little bit of stuff on the Roswell case. Don't want to do a whole lot because I've discussed it all before, and then talk about the things that I've been involved in since I got back from Iraq. So that's kind of what I've been working on. I've got my columns, of course, coming out in UFO Magazine, do stuff on my blog all the time, just put up something. Well, it was just a brief little article about the survey I ran for the last month, kind of an analysis of that, and just seeing what's going to happen from here on in.
Sure. Again, you can visit his website, which is www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. And, you know, I really want to thank you again for joining us today on Out of Touch Radio. I know you're a busy man, and we look forward to possibly having you back again, huh?
Oh, I'd love to do it again. Not a problem.
You are our hero when it comes to UFOs. So
well,
with that... go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say I appreciate that, considering that many of the things I talked about tonight were sort of negative. You know, what do you think about abductions? What do you think about this? It's kind of negative, but I think to understand what UFOs are and what we're dealing with, we need to look critically at all sorts of aspects of the UFO phenomenon.
And you know what? We appreciate that because, you know, you will be the first one to debunk before anyone. So we appreciate that, and we appreciate you being here. And we're going to leave you with this song here. Thanks again, Kevin.
Not a problem.
Thank you, Leslie. Again, our guest today was Kevin. And www.com. Listeners, make sure that you stop by our website, which is www.outoftouchradio.com. You can listen to our past shows, and also more information about guests that have appeared. Next time.